طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone. This is John Roberts welcoming you to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This morning we take a long look at the history of Palestinian-Israeli negotiations from a man who was inside the room for many of those historic events, Khaled El-Gindi. Khaled El-Gindi was a non-resident senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on a permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations held throughout 2008. His most recent book is Blind Spot: America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. Here he is speaking to the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in Washington, D.C. on December 12th, 2019.
So today I thought I would talk a little bit about sort of where we are and, more importantly, how we got here, and then offer up some few thoughts at the end on where I think things might be headed. I guess the big news flash is that the peace process is dead. Sorry to be the one to break the news to you all, but it is a thing of the past. I think the real news isn't that the peace process is dead, but that it wasn't Donald Trump who killed it. Before getting into that, let's look at what the Donald Trump approach has been, the so-called deal of the century, or what some in the administration have called the ultimate deal. Certainly no shortage of hyperbole in the Trump administration. The first component of the Trump vision was unveiled at Bahrain in a workshop in June. It's about 50. It's a program that envisions about $50 billion. That's billion with a B in aid, development, and investment projects for Palestinians and the rest of the region. Just in terms of comparison, the most recent previous economic plan that accompanied the peace process under Secretary of State John Kerry in the Obama administration in 2014 was around $4 billion. So we're looking at orders of magnitude greater, at least the theory is certainly bigger. Again, I think very much in keeping with the Trump approach of big and glitzy. Of course, the Palestinians did not attend that conference, that workshop, and they've been boycotting Washington since December 2017, when the Trump administration recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital and decided to move the U.S. embassy there, reversing 70 years of U.S. policy and going against a very broad international consensus on the issue of Jerusalem. The political component of the Trump plan has been delayed repeatedly and has now been postponed indefinitely. We've seen over the past 2 years, they would announce something is going to be out in March, and then March would come in and say, no, maybe June, and then June would come and say, maybe September. It was always after the Israeli elections. Of course, Israelis are having interminable, are in a perpetual electoral cycle. So in any case, the details of the plan, I think, don't matter, if in fact it is at all an actual plan in the way we understand peace plan. Because we already know a great deal already about what's in the Trump plan and specifically what's not in it. Since December 2017, the Trump administration has worked systematically to redefine the basic terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and its eventual settlement, and have worked effectively to destroy the possibility of a two-state solution. I don't mean that hyperbolically. I think that's not an exaggeration. I think it is the primary focus of the Trump vision to basically take the two-state solution off the map, off the table, and make it very hard even for a future administration to go back to it. First, as we mentioned already, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, that took Jerusalem off the table. In fact, those are the exact words that Trump used when he did that, that Jerusalem was now off the table. Then we saw the elimination of money for UNRWA, Palestinian refugees, and even more, I think, insidiously, an attempt to take the refugee issue off the table, essentially by redefining the status of who would qualify as a Palestinian refugee and basically defining them out of existence. We've seen also how the administration has erased the term occupation from all of their internal reporting. We see the American ambassador to Israel, Mr. Friedman, referring to Judea and Samaria, of course, the term that extremist Israeli settlers use. In fact, actually, all Israelis use that terminology. But it is for an American to use that terminology, hints of a certain ideological predisposition. And since then, we've also seen how the Trump administration has eliminated virtually every form of assistance to Palestinians inside and outside Palestine. We're talking about projects that predate Oslo going back to the mid-1970s. And most recently, their declaration by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that settlements, in the view of the administration, are no longer going to be considered illegal. This was the final nail, I think, in the coffin of UN Security Council Resolution 242 and the entire Land for Peace formula that has been, that has undergirded the US-led peace process and, in fact, all international diplomacy, Arab-Israeli diplomacy, since 1967. In short, this is a full frontal assault on a two-state solution and on Palestinian rights. And it is, in fact, this assault that is the deal of the century. In the meantime, facts on the ground, of course, are only getting worse. And I'm just going to do a quick sort of run-through of the facts on the ground. I'm sure most of you are familiar, but for those of you who aren't, of course, the occupied territories consist of three areas: the West Bank, and within that, the most strategic and most important for both Israelis and Palestinians is the area around Jerusalem, and of course the Gaza Strip. So looking first at the West Bank, obviously you have here, well, I guess a portion of the West Bank is cut off, but I guess it doesn't matter. So here you see a base map, of course, of the West Bank in white, the major Palestinian towns, mostly running along the central ridge of the West Bank. Here you see Palestinian population centers, the main built-up areas, and the settlements. The settlements themselves don't, in terms of the built-up areas, don't take up a whole lot of space, roughly around between 1 and 2% of the West Bank territory. But the settlements as an infrastructure, as an enterprise, of course, is much bigger, because we're talking about settlements, their jurisdiction areas, municipal control areas, their fenced-in areas, roads and other infrastructure, and all of which, of course, is secured by the Israeli military. So it is a much more elaborate phenomenon. Of course, I mentioned the roads. The red line is the traditional Palestinian road network, which you'll notice is mainly north-south, given the topography and the geography of Palestine being a very long, narrow strip of country. While the Israeli road network, of course, is an east-west phenomenon, and acts to break up and fragment Palestinian territory itself. The wall being one of the newer forms or developments in the Israeli settlement enterprise, was begun in around the year 2002, and is designed primarily to secure Israeli control over the main settlement blocks. Of course, settlement expansion is happening on both sides of the wall, but this was this really, for a lot of American policymakers, they saw the wall when it was being constructed as sort of the end point. This is the maximum that Israel would take. Whereas when I was based in Ramallah and we were presenting maps to international visitors, very similar to what I'm showing you now. In fact, this is based on PowerPoints that we would deliver to foreign diplomats when I was advising the Palestinian negotiating team. We would often hear from Americans that, oh, well, that's the maximum. The wall is the maximum, and then they would negotiate inward. Whereas we consistently argued, and it now turns out that we were right, that this was the starting point. The wall was only the beginning. It wasn't the end. In any case, moving forward, the internal closures is another less visible and more difficult even to show visually, which is the internal closures. Internal closures being the elaborate system of physical barriers, checkpoints, some of which are roving checkpoints, some of which are stationary, some of which are manned or unmanned, and physical barriers around certain areas of the West Bank, in some cases surrounding entire villages or towns, that restrict Palestinian movement within the West Bank. Now, when we overlay on top of this reality the political and legal reality, which is the Oslo framework, areas A and B, you'll see how it conforms. You know, it's not a surprise. Oslo conforms very neatly to realities on the ground. In other words, it took the facts on the ground as their starting point. And so the picture that we have is this very discontiguous, discombobulated Palestinian reality of fragmentation. George W. Bush looked at a map once like this and famously called it a Swiss cheese map and said that the Palestinians won't have a Swiss cheese state. In fact, where we are now is that they won't have any sort of a state. But this is the reality that Palestinians live in. 3.2 million Palestinians living in 40% of the West Bank, a fraction of that, 620,000 or so Israeli settlers, who have free reign over the majority of the occupied West Bank. Focusing in now on the situation in Jerusalem, again, you see the West Bank in white, Palestinian population centers in gray, and Israel in dark gray, and the settlements. Of course, this is where the settlement project is the most robust and the most strategic, designed to do two things. Obviously, secure the main part of Jerusalem, particularly the old city. So we have an inner ring of settlements around the old city and an outer ring of major settlement blocks around Jerusalem. And that's designed both to cut the west to have sort of unbroken access between Israel, East Jerusalem, and the Jordan Valley to the east, but also to break Palestinian contiguity between the northern West Bank and the southern West Bank. The whole settlement enterprise is deliberate and planned and very, very strategic with those aims in mind. So the final picture looks something like this in Jerusalem. Obviously, it's a very, very fragmented reality for Palestinians in Jerusalem. And as a result, 350,000 or so Palestinians are cut off from the rest of the West Bank. They're internally fragmented within East Jerusalem. And of course, they get separate and unequal services as compared with Israeli citizens in other parts of Jerusalem. And combined with the closure of institutions, which is an ongoing phenomenon in which Israel is really trying to eliminate any vestige of Palestinian cultural, historical, certainly political. Orient House and other political institutions were closed almost 20 years now ago. But since then, there's been a real crackdown on any manifestation of Palestinian identity in Jerusalem, no matter how benign. The result is that Jerusalemites have become kind of political orphans. They are not part of the PA, and they're not Israeli citizens. They're denied basic services by Israel. The poverty rates in Jerusalem are much higher in East Jerusalem than they are in West Jerusalem, and certainly higher than they are in other parts of the West Bank. And so it's not a coincidence that we've seen this kind of periodic unrest in Jerusalem in particular. The other area where we've seen considerable violence, of course, is Gaza. 2 million Palestinians under now more than 12 years blockade, and we've seen repeated wars in which thousands of Palestinians, mostly civilians, have been killed. And Gaza, for all intents and purposes, has become unlivable. The primary culprit, of course, in terms of the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza is unquestionably the Israeli-imposed blockade, which is a blockade that also is supported by Egypt and, to an extent, the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. But I think very much it's very important to emphasize that Gaza and its dire situation is a reflection of an all-around failure. It's a failure of the peace process, certainly, which has neglected it almost entirely since 2006. And it's a failure of Palestinian leadership as much as it is a result of Israeli policy and American neglect or international neglect. So I'll sort of turn back to the basic talk with those facts on the ground. I'll leave that up on the screen. So how did we get here? The Trump administration likes to claim that they've embarked on a radical new approach because, of course, we've seen so many past failures, and so why would you keep doing the same thing over and over if it hasn't worked? What I'm arguing, and what I'm arguing in the book, is that what Trump has done is not so much a new approach as it is the culmination of the old approach, maybe in its most exaggerated form. But the trend lines are more or less in the same direction. Trump openly rejects the Land for Peace formula and Resolution 242, and in fact, the very notion of a rules-based international order. That's for maybe another talk. But the basic ground rules of the peace process were already being eroded for years by previous U.S. administrations. It's also true that Trump doesn't recognize even the existence of an Israeli occupation. But at the same time, for years, U.S. administrations have downplayed the centrality of the occupation and instead have focused the peace process on secondary issues, and in some cases even tertiary issues like institution building, economic development, security, and so forth. All of these are important, but they're not the drivers of the conflict in the way that Israel's occupation is. Even the Jerusalem Embassy Act that required the president to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, and the anti-PLO laws that allowed Trump to shut down the PLO embassy here in Washington, both of these were Oslo-era laws that were passed at the height of the peace process in the 1990s. A reminder that the peace process was always shaped as much and sometimes more by its opponents as it was by its supporters. To understand why the Oslo process failed, we have to look at the unique form of American mediation. In a normal mediation, a mediator will look at the two sides, or if there are more than two sides, look at the power dynamics between the two sides, and look at the internal political dynamics of each side, because these are the two forces that are motivating and constraining any negotiating team, because when you're in the negotiating room, the conditions outside the negotiating room are just as important as, and very often more important than whatever is being discussed around the table. But that wasn't how American mediation worked. What I argue in the book is that American mediation was based on two faulty assumptions. The first was that for peace to succeed, Israel must feel secure militarily, politically, and otherwise for Israeli leaders to be able to quote, take risks for peace. This is explicit. This is what we've heard from every administration since at least Bill Clinton. The second is sort of an unspoken assumption, which is that Palestinian internal politics is something that can be ignored or maybe even better, re-engineered to support the needs of the peace process or to match the needs of the peace process as interpreted by the United States, right? These two areas represent the two sides of what I call the blind spot, a blindness to the very asymmetrical power imbalance and especially Israel's occupation. The flip side of that is a blindness to internal Palestinian politics and how it affects Palestinian decision making, and in fact, very often the success of the process itself. So there's a tendency to downplay the power asymmetry on the other, on one hand, total indifference or insensitivity to Palestinian internal politics in contrast to the enormous sensitivity and deference to Israeli internal politics. So the impetus for this book came from my experience in the negotiations. Specifically, in 2007, right after George W. Bush announced what became the Annapolis Conference. And at the time, as I mentioned, I was an advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team, and I became a part of that Annapolis process. But I was struck, like most of my colleagues, about the timing of that announcement. It was in the fall of 2007, just a few weeks after Hamas had violently taken control of the Gaza Strip and expelled Abbas and Fatah and the PA forces from the Gaza Strip. And 18 months before that, Abbas and his Fatah party had been defeated in a major election, in parliamentary elections. So it struck me as odd that whereas Mahmoud Abbas had been pushing for negotiations since he came to power in 2005 and got no traction from the U.S. administration, it was only after Abbas lost both a civil war and a major election that the United States suddenly decided this was the optimal moment to push towards negotiations. Of course, from my standpoint, I think the standpoint of most of my colleagues, negotiations was basically an empty exercise because Abu Mazen at that point had been so weakened that he was incapable of making any major compromises. And in fact, many Palestinians questioned whether he had a mandate or the legitimacy to negotiate on these issues, given the internal division and the fact that his party lost an election. And of course, as we've seen, the negotiations didn't succeed after that. Both of these concepts, both of these ideas of the blind spot, the blindness to Israeli power and a blindness to Palestinian politics, actually go back many years. We can trace their origins back to Balfour. But specifically in terms of an American-led peace process, they can be traced back to a man by the name of Henry Kissinger, who was, as you probably know, a very powerful Secretary of State and before that, National Security Advisor to President Nixon and President Ford. Both of these ideas Kissinger was a strong proponent of both of these ideas. On one hand, that the success of the peace process depends on the preeminence of Israel as a regional power and, of course, by extension, of the United States as a global power. And also, he was kind of the author of the view that Palestinian politics and political leaders is not something that should be indulged with. It's not something that should be accommodated. But in fact, he viewed Palestinian politics as something more like a pathology, something that needed to be cured or quarantined or contained somehow to not, so as to not infect the real decision makers, who were the Arab leaders, the leaders of Arab states, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and so on. In practice, this meant two things. One, that we had a constant tension between, on the one hand, the needs of the peace process and U.S. interests, on one hand, and on the other hand, the demands of the special relationship with Israel. This has led to a sort of chronic ambivalence. By ambivalence, I don't mean indifference. The United States has not been indifferent in the Middle East, and certainly not towards Israel. But by ambivalence, I mean sort of holding two conflicting views at the same time, or holding one view while acting in a different direction, or holding an official view while taking actions that are in the opposite direction. This is not uncommon in diplomacy, but it is particularly defined and, I think, egregious in the case of Israel and Palestine and America's role in that process. The other thing that it meant was that the two strongest parties, Israel and the United States, had both the means and the motive to shift as many of the political costs and risks as possible onto the weakest party, the Palestinians. So this is how the process was conducted. There are three main parties: the parties to the conflict, Israelis and Palestinians, and the Americans. The power dynamics among the three and the political dynamics among them are paramount, and they have essentially dictated the success or failure of this process. So what I'm arguing is that the U.S. didn't just fail in its mediation between Israel and the Palestinians. U.S. mediation actually made an agreement more difficult to achieve, and the situation on the ground that we just looked at even worse. The peace process, it did this by deepening the power imbalance between the two sides, which of course exacerbated the conflict, as we've seen repeatedly in places like Gaza and even in East Jerusalem. It's not a coincidence that the two areas that have seen the most regular episodes of violence, Jerusalem and Gaza, are also areas that have been exempted from the peace process. The other way it contributed to a failing peace process was by weakening Palestinian leaders and institutions, the exact opposite of what it set out to do. And so the result is you have Palestinian leaders who don't have the capacity or the political or legitimacy to make the kind of compromises that are needed to secure a deal, or even to really effectively rule over their people. As a result, since 1993, successive American administrations have worked both for and against the goals of the peace process at the same time. So in a way, the peace process died what I would call a sort of death by a thousand cuts. Bill Clinton and especially George W. Bush did the most damage. They did the most stabbing, if you will, of the peace process. Obama didn't do as much damage, but essentially inherited a patient that was hemorrhaging and let it bleed out. He didn't really do much by way of triage, much less any sort of life-saving measures. So that left Trump able to take advantage of a vacuum that had been left by where there used to be a peace process. So he was able to take advantage of a peace process that had already ceased to function. And as we've seen, he has come in redefining the terms of the peace process as we've understood it. Just to kind of quickly go through the last three administrations, this kind of death by a thousand cuts, starting with President Clinton. In my view, Bill Clinton represented both the best and the worst of what American mediation had to offer. On the one hand, he shattered taboos like hosting Yasser Arafat at the White House on numerous occasions, something like a dozen times. He really brought the PLO in from the cold. The PLO was a pariah organization. It was also financially bankrupt. And in a way, the Oslo process saved it. But even in terms of American politics, where the PLO and Yasser Arafat had been seen as kind of arch-terrorists, Bill Clinton helped rehabilitate the image of the PLO inside American politics. But he also broke with important international precedents. He was the first U.S. administration to stop reaffirming UN General Assembly Resolution 194 that affirmed the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes. And since then, of course, that precedent has been maintained by subsequent presidents. And he was also the first to stop referring to settlements as an obstacle to peace. On the one hand, he said settlements were bad and wanted Israel, and he even tried to negotiate with Israel some kind of a settlement freeze. But the Clinton administration insisted that settlements are no longer an obstacle to peace. So sort of raises the question, if they're not an obstacle to peace, why do you want them to be frozen? He was also the president, I think, who laid the foundation of what could have been a bilateral relationship between the United States and the Palestinians. Not entirely independent of Israel, of course, because there's still an occupation and everything has to go through Israel. But the United States extended its, for example, the United States extended its free trade agreement with Israel to include a trade from Palestine. We saw moments of real empathy by Bill Clinton on issues like Palestinian prisoners, where he spoke passionately and even brokered deals that related to Palestinian prisoners. And of course, there was the historic visits of Clinton and First Lady Hillary Clinton to Bethlehem and Gaza in 1998, in which he became the first American president to address the Palestinian Central Committee of the PLO in the Gaza Strip. That was the peak of the Oslo process. And he was able to sort of boost Yasser Arafat's leadership through that kind of soft power, I would call it, while delicately putting some mild pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu, who was also then prime minister in the late 1990s. But I would say Bill Clinton's biggest contributions came during the final months of his term in office. Bill Clinton came closer to this day, I would say, he came closer to any president before or since to brokering a conflict-ending resolution between Israelis and Palestinians. Between the Camp David summit in July 2007 and the Clinton parameters of December... did I say 2007?
Yeah.
Yeah, 2000, sorry. And then the Clinton parameters a few months later, also in 2000. But he also worked against that very goal of reaching a two-state solution. Specifically after the Camp David summit failed and the outbreak of the Intifada in a few weeks later in September of 2000. Even though it was clear that all sides had made mistakes at Camp David and contributed to its failure, Bill Clinton still put the blame on Yasser Arafat, even despite a pledge to Arafat personally that he would not blame the Palestinians if the summit failed. And it was one of the conditions that Arafat had insisted on before going to Camp David. So he joined Ehud Barak in saying, Arafat's not a partner. He's the reason this summit failed. But also after the outbreak of violence, and it was clear even to folks at the State Department, that the violence was being fueled by actions on both sides. The Israelis would use excessive force against mostly unarmed protesters, eventually causing those unarmed protesters to become armed. The more the Palestinian casualties mounted, the more the uprising was weaponized and militarized. And so we saw this gradual militarization of the Intifada that happened in late 2000 and early 2001, most of which was on Bill Clinton's watch. And yet, again, most of the onus for the responsibility and the blame was pinned onto the Palestinians, despite the very lopsided casualty situation. Even though it was understandable politically, given the special relationship not only between the United States and Israel, but between the persons of Bill Clinton and Ehud Barak, it still had repercussions, specifically in terms of narrowing the political space for an agreement in the very limited time left in Clinton's term, emboldening opponents of the peace process on both sides, of course, as casualties mount, becomes harder to political positions harden and political will hardens. And it, of course, it cemented the whole no partner narrative that was being peddled at that time by the Israeli leadership. Then you get George W. Bush. And I would say without hesitation that no U.S. president did more lasting damage to before or since. So these sort of, in some ways, the opposite of Bill Clinton. No president did more damage to prospects for a two-state solution than George W. Bush. On the one hand, again, we see this ambivalence. On the one hand, he was the first president to call officially for the creation of a Palestinian state. But he was also the president who basically gave Ariel Sharon a green light to systematically destroy the institutions, the governing and security institutions of the Palestinian Authority, which are supposed to be, of course, the embryo of a future Palestinian state. And we saw, from a philosophical standpoint, a return to the Kissinger mindset of Palestinian politics as a pathology. And I'm sorry for the over-alliteration. We saw that in the demand by George W. Bush that there could be no new diplomatic process until Palestinians elected new leaders and put an end to the violence. Again, the onus for the violence was put on the weaker party, the Palestinians. But now we had a new demand, which is that Palestinians had to elect new leaders who were, quote, not compromised by terror. Yet even after Palestinians did both of those, Palestinians elected a new leadership in the person of Mahmoud Abbas in 2005, which was the same year that he brokered an internal hudna, or truce, among Palestinian factions that basically brought the Intifada to an end. So they had a new leadership and an end to the violence, and yet there still was no political process, as the Americans had promised. And as I mentioned earlier, that took another 2 years. It was really only after the Gaza civil war that process began. I mean, one of the more telling examples is the roadmap. The roadmap, if you remember, was the peace plan put together jointly by the United States, the European Union, Russia, and the United Nations. But it was principally an American-authored document. This was Colin Powell's baby, the roadmap. So the United States was the principal author of the roadmap, which was supposed to correct many of the flaws of the Oslo process, but then was the first to abandon it almost immediately after it was released. The biggest test, I think, or the most telling example, I think, was after Hamas's election. Of course, the election of a group that is a designated foreign terrorist organization, officially designated by the United States government, is highly problematic on legal terms, in political terms, and even in moral terms. At the same time, the Bush administration refused any and all attempts or gestures by Hamas and other Palestinians at somehow moderating Hamas's position. Hamas had offered things like an extended, they wouldn't recognize Israel, but they offered an extended truce, a 10-year truce. They were no longer calling for Israel's destruction, but were now prepared to settle for a state within the 1967 borders, in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, sort of bringing them in line with the broader Palestinian consensus. But the Bush administration refused any scenario that would allow Hamas to remain in government, even in a partnership with Fatah, the so-called Mecca Accord, in which there was a unity government agreed to between Hamas and Fatah. It was completely rejected, even though Hamas had been willing to give up most of the government portfolios, even though it was entitled, having won the election, to form the government all by itself. Rather than using the Hamas election as an opportunity to build on or maybe even test Hamas's moderation or at least its gestures, Bush adopted a zero-sum approach in which there was no way Hamas could remain in government. This put Abbas in the impossible situation of having to choose between between negating the outcome of a free election, which would inevitably lead to a civil war, or, on the other hand, indefinite international isolation spearheaded by the United States and Israel. So it really was a lose-lose for Mahmoud Abbas. As you all know, a civil war ensued. And the Palestinian Authority has been divided ever since. So by the time Obama comes to office in 2009, both the peace process and Palestinian politics are completely in shambles. Obama had come in just after the war in Gaza, known as Casled, in which 1,400 Palestinians were killed, 15,000 homes destroyed, and at the same time, 13 Israelis, including 3 civilians, were killed. We saw also a return of the right-wing Israeli government that was more committed than any of its predecessors to the settlement project. And on the other side, of course, you have a divided and dysfunctional Palestinian Authority. We saw massive settlement growth throughout the Oslo years. The beginning of Oslo in 1993, there were something like 270,000 settlers. By the time Obama came to office, there were about 500,000, almost doubling throughout a period that was supposed to be a peace process. Meanwhile, Gaza remained isolated, the West Bank remained fragmented. So to deal with this reality, this physical, political mess that Obama inherited, it would really require a radical new approach to the peace process. And for a lot of people, they saw Obama as the last best hope for a two-state solution. At first, it looked like Obama might actually be willing to chart a different course. He took a firm stand on settlements, very much unlike Bush. He said not some settlements should be frozen, all settlements should be frozen. I don't mean outposts or natural growth. He and his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, were very explicit in trying to close those old loopholes. And he even alluded to ending the siege in Gaza. But as soon as he got pushback, and he got immediate pushback from Congress and the pro-Israel lobby. Of course, this is back then we had both houses were controlled by the Republican Party. So as soon as he got pushback, Obama caved. He gave up on the settlement freeze, and of course, Gaza was again relegated to the neglect that it had received before. Obama had several opportunities to break new ground or even leave his mark on the peace process. And instead, not only opted for a minimalist approach but actually worked to preserve the status quo. One of the biggest paradoxes of the Obama presidency, in my view, is that even as he gave up on the idea of a settlement freeze that he himself had insisted on, even though it was clear to everyone that settlements directly harm a two-state solution, he aggressively opposed what? Not settlements, but Mahmoud Abbas's bids to gain recognition of a Palestinian state at the United Nations, even though he was essentially affirming a two-state solution, but wanted to do it officially in the United Nations. So on the one hand, ignored settlements, which everyone agreed was detrimental to two states, but the thing that he fought aggressively, diplomatically, on a global scale, was trying to defeat Mahmoud Abbas's mostly symbolic recognition of Palestinian statehood at the UN. There's a real, you know, you get a sense that even with a president like Obama, that ambivalence really runs deep. By 2013, the peace process existed only in name. Prime Minister Salam Fayyad, who was widely hailed even in Israel as a huge success in building the institutions of a future Palestinian state, yet we saw no progress toward Palestinian statehood. Instead, Palestinians actually got new sanctions that were imposed by Congress in response to Abbas and his decision to go to the United Nations in 2011 and 12. In 2014, we saw the simultaneous collapse of negotiations and yet another more devastating war in Gaza, followed by another round of violence in Jerusalem. And so in a very real sense, we had neither peace nor process. The process had failed both as a conflict resolution mechanism and even at the more modest goal of containing or managing the conflict. There was nothing. With the clock winding down on the administration, many urged Obama to take some drastic step to save a two-state solution. If you remember, at that time, John Kerry had said, two-state solution has two and a half years before it's dead. That was 6 or 7 years ago. And yet, even with that sense of urgency, so many had urged Obama to take some sort of drastic step, like putting out permanent status parameters that would kind of freeze the two-state solution, even if it couldn't be implemented, or perhaps even recognize a Palestinian state. But even with a Trump administration or a president-elect Trump waiting in the wings, Obama again opted for doing the absolute minimum. Instead of any of these more substantive options, he simply decided to abstain from a UN resolution that condemned Israeli settlements. It was an important resolution, and it was very important and consequential that it was allowed to pass, but it was the only thing that he did, having a few years earlier actually vetoed a very similar resolution. And so the inertia and minimalism of the Obama years left an opening for Trump, who, as we've seen, is not committed to a two-state solution or to any of the principles that undergird it. In effect, Trump has been trying to redefine both the conflict and the terms of its resolution by turning the clock back not to the pre-Oslo or pre-Madrid period, but to the pre-1967 era, when Palestinians were viewed mainly as an economic, humanitarian, and a security problem rather than a political one. In sum, the peace process failed because it was totally and very fundamentally divorced from reality and created a system of accountability for only one party, which is the weaker side. Palestinian compliance rarely brought any rewards, and Israeli violations and excesses rarely carried any costs. U.S. officials were vigilant in holding Palestinians accountable, but rarely, if ever, did so for Israel. Not for settlements, not on human rights violations, not on excessive force, on nothing. It's a basic rule of law issue. If the rules apply only to one side, and it's the weaker side, the process loses all meaning and, in fact, cannot function. So where do we go from here? Well, as I said, the peace process is dead, but that doesn't necessarily mean a two-state solution is dead. It's still theoretically possible, although it's hard to imagine how we get there without a credible process in place. And what makes it even harder is that there's no longer a credible mediator. The United States has been essentially discredited as a mediator, certainly by among Palestinians, but I think increasingly, particularly under the Trump administration, in the international community as well. And we've seen rebuke after rebuke by the Europeans, by the UN, of these various measures that the U.S. has taken unilaterally on Jerusalem, on settlements, or on refugees. We've seen the international community essentially rebuke the Trump administration. So there is no process and there is no mediator. And as it turns out, there is actually no alternative to either of them. There is no power or set of powers that I can think of or that anyone seems to be able to conceive of that has the credibility with both sides and that can effectively manage or mediate an end to this conflict. The political and physical realities on the ground are all working against a peaceful resolution. As I said, there's neither peace nor even a process. Israeli leaders are triumphalist and have no incentive to seek any form of compromise. Palestinian leaders are divided, weak, and dysfunctional. The PLO has been hollowed out. The PA is on the verge of collapse. And as we've seen, lacks any real strategy or vision. While prospects for a two-state solution look increasingly grim, a one-state solution with equal rights is also not yet politically viable. If only because the vast majority of Israeli Jews reject the idea. And in fact, even on the Palestinian side, where there is the most support for a one-state solution with equal rights, there is currently no political actor that is carrying the banner of a one-state solution. Not Fatah, certainly, not even Hamas. Even Hamas is now within the de facto acceptance of a two-state solution. Whether, of course, they've hedged their position somewhat, so it's not entirely clear or coherent. But there isn't a political there may be a constituency for a one-state solution, but there isn't a political actor that is rallying around that on the Palestinian scene. So we're in this kind of limbo of neither one state nor two. However, the situation is not all doom and gloom. The blind spot is in many ways giving way to a bright spot, however modest. While it's clear that Trump is trying to rewrite the rules of the game and redefine the conflict, there are a few important obstacles standing in his way. The first is that, as I already mentioned, the international community is not likely to go along with his project. More importantly, there are real changes happening inside American politics. We've seen this over the past few decades, but particularly in recent years, a growing partisan divide between Republicans and Democrats on this issue that is opening up new space for debate. We're seeing this with Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and the Bernie Sanders campaign and other Democratic campaigns as well. And while there have always been, and this is one of the reasons why I looked at the whole 100 years, there have always been voices in American politics speaking out for Palestinian rights. Going back to the Balfour Declaration, there was a hearing in 1922. There were, in Congress, there were voices, American liberal voices, saying Balfour will fundamentally deny the Palestinian majority their basic right to self-determination. So there have always been these political figures at various moments in American history. The Jesse Jackson campaign, others in American politics. But for the first time ever, I think we're seeing the emergence of a political constituency, and not just political elites, that care about Palestinian rights. And we're seeing that particularly in the Democratic Party, and specifically the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And you can see the fruits of that in things like the Bernie Sanders campaign, and to an extent also the Elizabeth Warren campaign, and others who are sort of nibbling at the edges of some of the more progressive discourse on this issue. For the first time, we're seeing more than one Democratic candidate talking about conditioning aid to Israel. And what's remarkable is that this is happening in a campaign environment. It's one thing for George H.W. Bush to condition loan guarantees on Israeli settlement freeze in 1991 or two. That's different. You know, he's an elected president. He's a sitting president. But to do it in the context of an election campaign is very, very new because, as most of you know, so much of this policy is driven by forces of American domestic politics. So what that suggests is that that sort of underscores the shift that has happened in American policy. And so while we've seen this change happen in American policy, it hasn't necessarily trickled up yet in politics. It hasn't trickled up yet to affect the policy, but we don't know what might happen. All of these, I think, present an opportunity to dramatically change the conversation on Israel and Palestine and potentially to change the U.S. role in the conflict. It is pointless, in my view, and I'm going to end now. So it is pointless, in my view, to talk about a U.S.-led peace process or a return to negotiations. The best we can hope for is to have an honest and frank debate. And this is not something to be diminished. And we haven't had a real honest debate on Israel and Palestine for decades. I think the last time was probably in the early, mid-1970s. That debate can no longer just be between variations of the pro-Israel spectrum from the left or the right, but must also include voices that prioritize Palestinian rights, aspirations, and narratives. And in many ways, I believe that process has already begun. Thank you.
You have been listening to Khaled El-Ghindi speaking in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.